Hello, and welcome to Anaphylaxis UK's Let's Talk About Allergies podcast, where we provide expert answers to common questions about allergies and anaphylaxis. Our goal is to offer valuable insights on how we can all work together to make life easier and safer for those living with allergies.
Welcome back to Let's Talk About Allergies, where today we're discussing a topic that's all too familiar for people living with food allergies: misinformation and myths. Christmas is a time for festive meals and gatherings, but for people with food allergies, it can also mean dodging well-meaning but often misinformed comments from friends and family. So today, we're joined by Dr. Helen Evans-Howes, a GP with an extended role in allergy and trustee of Anaphylaxis UK, to bust some of the most common myths about food allergies that you might hear at Christmas. So whether you're hosting someone with allergies this Christmas or want to better understand the challenges faced by people living with them, stay tuned for an informative conversation.
Dr. Helen, thanks for joining.
No worries.
Good to have a conversation with you again in your new clinic. We're going to talk about some of the things that people often have in conversation and those sorts of myths and the sort of strange things sometimes people might say to somebody with an allergy or about anaphylaxis, and just a conversation really to dispel some of those misunderstandings. And very often we come across, you know, people that say, well, peanuts is the biggie, and that's the most serious of all of the allergies.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it frustrates people who, or families who have children with multiple other allergies, because we know that's not the case. So I think where that originally came from is that when we look to who has died from allergy, obviously it's really important that we always do case analysis to figure out why did this happen, what went wrong, and how can we prevent it for future people. And part of that data in the past would show that if you had a peanut allergy, there was a higher chance of the deaths being caused by that. Whereas actually with the data over the kind of last 10, 20 years, we've seen a shift from it being peanut allergy as one of the main causes of death, particularly in children, to actually being from cow's milk. So it's definitely not true that peanut is the only one that causes severe allergies. We know it does. And perhaps you could hypothesize that maybe some of the reasons that deaths have thankfully reduced from that is actually because schools are more aware of it now and try to restrict nuts going into it. People have more awareness around peanut allergy and are often a bit more cautious about it. Whereas cow's milk, for instance, that's not the case. It kind of is everywhere and hard to avoid.
And would a peanut allergy tend to be worse than a tree nut allergy in a reaction?
No, again, it's a myth that there really is no. If you're allergic to something with an immediate IgE-mediated allergy, any of them could trigger a severe allergic reaction, including anaphylaxis. And I've seen that from, obviously, I'm lucky enough to offer immunotherapy to help desensitize children against their food allergies. And actually, you know, peanut immunotherapy can be relatively straightforward, whereas one of the harder nuts we've seen is cashew nut, can be quite problematic to desensitize against. Mm. So, you know, but that's just personal experience of what I've seen, but it's definitely not true that peanut is the only one that causes severe reactions.
So just as concerning as egg, milk, all of the other allergies, allergens.
Yeah, egg is a slightly different in that, you know, I don't really like to focus on death because I mean, you know, part of our
motto
is how to live well with allergies. And there's around 10 deaths a year from food allergy. So it is extremely rare, but obviously it's catastrophic. When we look to those, egg is highly unlikely to ever cause that. It's not to say egg allergies can't be severe. I've still seen people end up on intensive care from their egg allergy. But part of the reason now that allergy clinics often don't see children with purely an egg allergy is because we know that it tends to be temporary for most. This is only for most because there are some people who are adults with egg allergy. And so if you haven't had a severe allergic reaction to eggs, say at weaning, then you will get given specific information from the allergy clinic, sending it to your GP or from your GP if they already know, about how and when to introduce baked egg as the first step to help see if we can build tolerance and then outgrow it. So allergy clinics don't automatically see everyone with an egg allergy because it tends to be temporary and less severe. But I caveat that with, but it still can be severe.
There are lots of people saying that you can grow out of an allergy. An egg, maybe what you're saying there is an example of that. But yeah. Peanut allergy, soy allergy, all of those, could you grow out of them?
Anybody can outgrow any of the allergies. So we know now from data that there's around 5% of children have a food allergy. And for adults, it's about 1% to 2%. It's always very hard to work out exact numbers. So you can see, therefore, that the majority of people would outgrow them. But your chances of outgrowing, say, a nut allergy is around 20%. And if it hasn't happened by school age, it's much less likely. There is hope. I've seen people come on like their 17th birthday, and or I've even had adults actually where I'll reassess them and their allergies seem to have gone. It's just less likely. So the time of the most change is in those preschool years when you'll see the allergies changing.
And again, people often say that when it'll start mild, and then maybe develop into a bit of a rash, the tingly mouth and so on, and then potentially get a lot worse and end in anaphylaxis.
Yeah, and all they'll say the opposite. That so they'll either say the reaction will get worse each time you get exposed, or if you've never had anaphylaxis, you can't. And both of those are just complete myths. And unfortunately, sometimes they originate from healthcare, because we know that allergy training is not brilliant at any level, at undergraduate or postgraduate level, for any of us. That's why I retrained, because I realised with my son I knew absolutely nothing as a GP. Some do, some are like me, and they've done extra qualifications or have personal experience. But an allergy reaction can vary time to time. So you're more likely to have a severe reaction if you've eaten larger quantities of it, if there is something called a cofactor present on the day. So if you are you're unwell, your body's fighting an illness, you've got poorly controlled asthma, you've exercised around the time, if you've had a hot bath or shower, that can trigger a worse reaction. Even taking ibuprofen can trigger a worse reaction. So those things can tip it to be anaphylaxis on one day and on another, just a rash. It is very variable. And that's why whenever I hear someone say, oh, their allergy is just mild, it always fills me with horror, because what it tells me is they haven't had any education.
I was going to ask that actually about mild allergies, because on one end of the spectrum, you hear that each reaction gets worse and worse the more that you eat that food. And then on the other side, people will say, if you only have a mild allergy and you only get a little bit of mouth tingling or hives, then if you continue to have small amounts of that allergen, then that will improve your tolerance to the allergy, to the allergen. So is there any truth behind that?
We have to be really careful. So the first thing is, people need a proper assessment, because there are different types of allergy that are sometimes a bit more complex to go into. But for instance, if some people only got an itchy mouth and they had pollen allergies, some foods like fruits and vegetables and some nuts, not all of them, can just give you an itchy mouth that doesn't carry with it anaphylactic risk. But that really needs assessment by someone who knows what they're talking about and can do the proper tests. So then I can tell you what your risk is from this food. Somebody at home going, oh, well, I know that they definitely have got peanut allergy, and I'm just going to, you know, I've heard about this thing called immunotherapy, which we're talking about more and more in the UK, and obviously I've just mentioned it, to try and build how much allergen that person can have. I'm just going to do that myself at home. I'm going to Google how to do it. It's extremely dangerous. It can't, you know, this is a newish field. It comes when I do the immunotherapy with a massive set of rules of give it on this day, don't give it on this day. You know, someone always at the end of the phone, you would be putting yourself or your child's life in danger by thinking that you could just do it yourself without support. So there is truth that if we build it slowly, we might be able to raise how much threshold they can have, but it carries with it anaphylactic risk, and you need a specialist to do it. No one should ever do it at home.
Sure. People sometimes wonder if they just have a mild reaction. Often I hear people refer to it as an intolerance, that they're allergic to peanuts, but they're intolerant to tree nuts.
Yeah.
Could you explain the myth there?
I think it just, you know, it rely. And again, this is always when people say these sorts of things to me, I always think, who have you been assessed by? If you're using these terms, they're just often bandied around in the wrong way. So an allergy is an abnormal response from the immune system. The ones that carry the anaphylactic risk are immediate IgE-mediated allergies, and they're the only ones you can test for. we've seen many infants and young children with non-IgE-mediated allergy tests, and some people might describe them as milder because they give you non-life-threatening symptoms, reflux, diarrhea. They tend to be miserable babies, eczema. They're not mild to the individual or to their family because they're, you know, really traumatizing and affect their quality of life. They don't generally carry a life-threatening risk, but they can have severer forms where it affects their growth. So obviously that's not great for them. Mm-hmm. And then there are other forms of allergy that present slightly differently that can be life-threatening. And intolerance is a reproducible adverse reaction. So it happens every time you eat the food that doesn't involve the immune system. And then you're tending to talk about other foods like lactose, for instance, which is a sugar present in milk. And it would usually just give them gut symptoms as on the whole. So when we're looking at children, it's not likely we're talking about intolerances for them. We're probably talking about allergies or some other condition. There are exceptions, but people being intolerant to, say, tree nuts, well, that would be a bit weird to me. I'm not sure what would be meant by that. So it depends on what the foods are that people are talking about.
Sure.
And have a proper assessment. And I was slightly perturbed. I think most of us are sort of allergy specialists, whereby Paul Turner's data that was published. So Paul is an expert dietitian. He's definitely not an expert allergist. And he looked at data in primary care over the last 20 years to look at people who'd been coded with possible allergy, probable allergy, or probable with an adrenaline auto-injector. And what was most shocking to me is that 95% of children never see a specialist, and 90% of adults never see a specialist. I think that's the data roughly right, which is saying that the vast majority of people will never have expert care. And this isn't me dismissing the quality of care you get from GPs, because I am one. But we know, I'm thinking, we're all honest amongst ourselves, most GPs do not get high enough level of training in allergy. And yet we're expecting them to manage these conditions, give people good, safe advice. However, allergy services would be utterly swamped if we sent them 90-95% of patients. But there is a huge proportion of people out there wandering around thinking they're allergic when they're not, or not really sure, or having these myths that, oh, it's only been a few hives, I'm never going to have anaphylaxis. And those are the people that we see die because nobody's given them the proper advice about always carry adrenaline auto-injectors, or they may not have even prescribed them. You know, what cautions do you need to take when you're eating out? It's a real worry. It's so unfair that in the UK we have so few allergy clinics.
That brings us nicely on to home testing, and we've got a podcast just on that. But
we have.
You know, let's say I think I'm allergic to something, and I pop down to the shop, I buy a home test kit, it comes back with a positive there. I then know, don't I? I'm 100% sure from those tests.
Yeah.
Why is that not right?
Because allergy tests just aren't, well, there's so many issues with it. And we've talked about it in more depth. More and more these days, there are some tests you can buy that are better and do check the IgE level to what you're looking at. But there's a huge spectrum. There are some that I've seen on the market that are utterly inaccurate. So they'll claim that they're checking the IgE level, and they never match up to anything I find in clinic with my skin prick tests or formal lab results. And what that just does is creates unnecessary anxiety for that person. And I've seen it cause massive worry because now they're told 20 foods cause allergy. Or they start taking foods out, which can potentially create allergy, or they're missing what they're actually allergic to. So there's so many issues. The other thing is that just because a blood test was negative, say, doesn't necessarily mean you're not allergic. So I use a kit, which is a home kit that people can use, that I know has got a good lab that I'm sending off to. And I had somebody recently, it tested negative, but he gave such a good history of peanut allergy. I said, no, I'm not happy. Let's do a skin prick test as well. And it was huge. He's definitely still got allergy. So, testing is only really ever as accurate as the assessment that goes with
it. Sure. So you need to have an accurate diagnosis from a specialist who can read your medical reports and medical history.
It's the history that goes with it. What happened? Yeah. Does it happen every time? What's the timing around this? The test really confirms what I'm already suspicious of, because even if the tests are negative and I'm suspicious, I'm not going to let you eat it until I've done a supervised food challenge and given it you and checked safely. Can you? Or even if it's positive, but I know you're eating this every day without allergic symptoms, I'm not going to take it out of your diet. So it has to go with somebody, which is why the NICE guidelines, so the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, say GPs shouldn't do allergy tests unless they have the experience to analyse them. And I would agree with that. They can do them, but only should do them if they know what they're talking about.
Let's talk about nuts and an area that confuses many people. So if you're allergic to, you've got a nut allergy, does it mean that you can eat chestnuts or pine nuts?
Yes.
Coconuts. Anything with nuts in the name.
Yeah, it's such a confusing term. If we think about it, we've got coconut, nutmeg, pine nut, chestnut, you know, pistachio nut, cashew nut, peanut. They're not all the same. So peanut is a legume. It's not actually a nut. Then you've got tree nuts, which would be cashew, pistachio, walnut, pecan, Brazil, almond, hazelnut, and macadamia nut. Pine nut is a seed. Chestnut is a seed. Coconut is a drupe. So it's not, they're not the same thing. And we saw this a lot when, what was that awful brand of drink that people wanted to drink for children? How can I not remember?
I know. Prime. Yeah.
Contained coconut milk. And suddenly we had a whole
school. Oh, really?
Yeah. Of adults saying, oh, my child's got a nut allergy, but they're desperate to have Prime because it was the in thing.
Sure.
Can they have coconut? And it made me realize how many people were unnecessarily avoiding coconut because just because you've got a peanut allergy or a tree nut allergy, for most people they would be fine with coconut, pine nuts. Definitely chestnut allergies would be quite unusual. And the other thing that people ask us about is macadamia. That's not macadamia, shea nut butter, that's fine. Nutmeg, that's not likely to cause issues either. So there's around 20% of people that would be allergic to peanut and tree nuts. But even more these days, we're seeing it's isolated tree nuts. So it might be peanut, cashew, pistachio, and say hazelnut, but not necessarily all of them. And actually, with the advent of immunotherapy, we are now really trying to work out which ones are you allergic to and which ones can you have in the diet. But it is a myth that you can't have any. You just need to have access.
That was one of the myths I was going to ask you about, is that people often say, you know, nut allergies include all nuts. And I get a lot of people on the helpline who they tend to be older adults who say, I'm allergic to all nuts. So I'm just wondering there, because you said that you're trying to figure out, you know, which nuts it is, because it would be unusual to be allergic to every single nut and tree nut, and peanut. So what could some advice be there for these people who have been told in, you know, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, that they're allergic to all nuts?
Yeah, so they could be. There are people who are allergic to all of them. Where it came from is there is a study showing that notoriously we're very poor at picking out nuts. So if you showed us cashew nuts, many of us won't know that's cashew nut versus hazelnut. So we felt in years gone by, if someone's allergic to nuts, it's just safer to say avoid all nuts to avoid the risk of contamination, which means that for most adults, they're probably wandering around not really knowing which ones they're allergic to. And I assess quite a lot of them and have said, oh, no, it's just peanut. You can have these tree nuts. Now the fear for them is very hard. They don't want to, but they might then be able to introduce it to their child. So whilst I've said GPs should only analyse if they are capable, you could speak to your GP and say, look, especially if you know your history, I know when I was little I reacted to X and I was told to avoid all. Either does your allergy record show that you've had testing for all of them, or could your GP send off a blood test to have a look at peanut and tree nuts? And if they're negative and you're clear that you never, ever have had a problem with them, maybe at least you know that you're going to be all right handling them and probably all right eating them. You know, in an ideal setting, I'd say go and see an allergist and have but we just know that you're going to probably be looking at like a 1 to 2 year wait, worse in some parts of the country. So have a chat with your GP, look at your old records if you've got any. And if you really don't know, would they consider doing some testing for you?
It can be very confusing, particularly with, you know, saying that a peanut is a legume.
Yeah.
People just don't get it. And I completely understand why. But there's loads of information on our website. And we've got a section there on nuts and peanuts. So it will detail out what is and what is not.
And droop seeds.
And seeds, yeah. And droops was
foods with nuts
word
in the name.
Me. Yeah, it's it can be very confusing, particularly as we're recording now, just before Christmas, and you know you've very often got that bowl of peanuts out. You've very often got the walnuts and the, you know, all the other the ingredients that include nuts.
Well, I think it's the only time of year where, not the only time, but it's the when some people have an isolated Brazil nut allergy, and it is probably the time of year where you need to worry, because it seems mm-hmm. only. Really that we eat Brazil nuts, but at the time of the year you don't. So generally when it comes to nut allergies, that's the one that is easier to avoid. Obviously all of these things have challenges, but at Christmas suddenly your Brazil nuts are out. So it's a really tricky time of year for anyone with any food allergies, to be honest, because the whole season is focused on food, and that makes it really difficult for people to socialize and go out if people around them don't understand and support what they're going through. And I think we have fact sheets on how to support, you know, eating out and...
we do indeed. On going on holiday.
Yeah,
definitely. And we've got a few podcast episodes with some psychologists who specialise in allergy to try and manage those anxieties and fears, especially at this time of year when it's such a social time and there's so much food around.
If you feel like you can't check the packets properly, and you know, don't let your guard down just because it is your mum or your best friend or whatever, they're not, you know, that expert in allergy that you've now become managing either your own allergies or your child's allergies. So even though people will go out of their way often to try and help, you need to have confidence that you are certain it doesn't contain that allergen. If you don't know and you can't check, just take something safe, and then you'll enjoy it a lot more than putting the trust in someone else, unless they can show you it definitely doesn't have the allergen in it.
And that leads quite nicely onto the myth that may contain products are fine for people with allergies, which people that don't have allergies often think, which is important at this time of year when you're buying products for people and you see the may contains and you think, oh, that's fine. That doesn't, you know, that's basically nothing in there. So, yeah, could you tell us a bit more about may contains?
In a snapshot, may contains are probably the bane of every allergy sufferer's life because it's just such a frustrating situation. So what is meant to happen is a manufacturer is meant to do a risk assessment of from the processing, the handling, the storage of this food, how likely is it to contain that allergen? And then if it might, but it hasn't directly got it as an ingredient, then they should put some sort of precautionary label on. And the labels can be anything: may contain, not suitable for, made in a factory. Someone nearby had a cup of tea once that had, you know, they can use whatever label they want. It's a nightmare. But there is no legality to have to label that. So foods that don't have a label could well have a risk. And we've seen that, you know, and we've seen recent, you know, things being withdrawn all the time. And foods that have got a label doesn't necessarily mean it's a risk either. And so you will often find that individuals will make their own risk assessment or have their own rules around it. And even allergists all have slightly different opinions on it. So I would normally say, if you've got a nut allergy, don't eat chocolate that's got a may contain or a precautionary label, because there's actually high risk of contamination, because I understand the manufacturing process. But if it's a jar of bolognese, it's probably fine. But if you're the person catering, you need to say to that person, what would you like us to do about these labels? What are the rules that you follow? And that is different from person to person. I have families who absolutely never risk it, and others who do a risk assessment, and there isn't a right or a wrong situation. We used to eat them as a family on the whole, but not chocolate. It is a disastrous situation, and there's much work going on behind the scenes to try and tidy it up, but it's not as easy as people think to make that labelling clearer.
No, it's not easy, and we're certainly working with a number of companies to make sure that the label, if it's there, it's there for a reason. But if we can get rid of it by changing some of the supply chain, some of the procedures, then let's get rid of that, because it is very often an unnecessary barrier that just makes it so difficult for people with an allergy.
And you can be frustrating. And we know that, like, milk, for instance, has got higher levels of cross-contamination within some of these foods. We've all heard of the stories of the vegan foods that are, of course, meant to be cow's milk free that are not. And, you know, that just shows some foods have higher levels of contamination, particularly with cow's milk and nuts. And I feel very sorry for people about that. And actually, that's why often allergy parents become amazing cooks, because they do everything from scratch. I was not. I was a shocking. I still am probably not a great cook. But yeah, some of the families that share pictures with me of the cakes and stuff, they're just absolutely phenomenal.
So we clearly encourage people to always take two adrenaline auto-injectors out with them at all times.
Yeah.
But very often people will say, well, I'm just popping out.
I know.
I might only take one with me. I'm just going out for 10 minutes, 20 minutes. I'm just popping to the shops. Why is that not safe?
Or you don't even, you just make a conscious, or you just don't. And I can fully identify that, because I've been that parent that son had anaphylaxis, and I didn't always carry the EpiPen. And I personally feel it goes back to the education that comes with that, that we are not told of the importance, that what we know, first of all, we're human beings, we're spontaneous. We might go out and suddenly go, a bit thirsty, I'm going to quickly go and get a drink, or you know, it's not super common, but you could have contamination that you could have touched the surfaces. I don't want people to freak out about that too much and stress too much. But, you know, if you're sitting chatting to someone, that can happen if there's a lot of residue left. So you just could never say for certain that you're not going to react. And we know particularly that if you are having anaphylaxis, then time is the absolutely crucial thing, that the quicker you use that adrenaline, and if you're in doubt, it's utterly safe to just use it, the quicker you'll reverse the reaction. Leave it and your blood vessels have already become leaky and you've lost your blood pressure, and it's much harder to come back from, you know, as I suppose it's a bit like a leaky tap. If you fix it early, you'll solve the problem. If it's suddenly flooding, you're going to be much harder to clear up the mess. That's not a great analogy, but it's that sort of thing. When we hear some of these deaths reported in the press recently, they haven't been carrying their adrenaline auto injectors. And this, by the way, is not me blaming people, because I've been that person. But also crucially, that they often run back for them, and the exercise triggers this exacerbation and worsening of a reaction. So if you don't take it with you, and that is sometimes life, just for goodness sake, just lay flat, lift your legs up. It'll help the flow of blood into your heart, and ring 999 and don't move till they get to you.
Can I just add there as well that when you do phone 999, it's very important to say anaphylaxis. Just use that word, anaphylaxis. Because that means it's a category one.
Yeah, definitely.
And the ambulance will turn up very quickly rather than it being necessarily a routine call, which very often means a longer wait for that ambulance to arrive.
Yeah, sadly, they triage it otherwise. If you say, oh, I think they've had an allergic reaction, they'll go through their triage pathways and not always get the right conclusion. Because this goes back to, unfortunately, allergy education across the board in healthcare has notoriously been poor, and we're working hard to change that. But you need to take ownership for being the one with the knowledge and saying, this is anaphylaxis, it's an emergency.
So speaking of adrenaline, you often hear people say that you only need adrenaline for a very serious allergic reaction. For example, when someone goes into anaphylactic shock. So I think there's I don't know if it's a myth, or rather people are misinformed that anaphylaxis is anaphylactic shock, which isn't the case. And you need adrenaline whether you're experiencing anaphylaxis or you're going into anaphylactic shock. Could you just explain the difference there?
Yeah, and I was the healthcare that didn't know that. So when Ethan had anaphylaxis, I actually thought he was mucking about. I thought he was pretending to cough. And it's a terrible story. I then was trying to get him to sleep, so I stopped looking at him. I've been like, please stop coughing. And then when I got him home, he was covered in hives and swollen. And I said to the allergy consultant at the time, you know, like, oh, this is a bit of a weird reaction. He was like, that's anaphylaxis. I said, no, it wasn't collapsed. I was like, no, that is anaphylaxis. So shock is like the more severe end, where you've then got changes in your bloodstream. So you'll drop your blood pressure, your heart rate will go through the roof. A lot harder for us to come back from that. And a lot of people bandy that term around. I had anaphylactic shock, and they don't. Anaphylaxis is, we would say, ABC. So A for airway, so constant coughing, voice going croaky like you've got a sore throat, tongue swelling. B for any signs of breathing problems, wheezy, noisy, increased breathing. And C for your conscious circulation level. So you might start feeling really dizzy, they might look pale, floppy, or collapse then comes into it. But if the first things you see are coughing, That's anaphylaxis. Treat it with adrenaline. You'll make that person feel better much quicker, and it will reverse it, and we'll have better hope that we'll not end up in a catastrophic situation. And we know it's safe. So the Americans teach, if you've got two signs of an allergic reaction, so hives and abdominal pain, treat. Now, their outcomes are no different. So I do think that's probably excessive, bearing in mind still an injection that if you know, for my son, he would have had an injection every 2 minutes because milk was very hard to avoid 15 years ago with labelling. But it shows that it doesn't cause harm. So if you were in a situation of going, oh, is it bad enough? Then the answer is yes, it's bad enough. Just use it. I'll unpick it afterwards with you if did you or didn't you need it, but not in a way to say, telling you off. And that's how some people feel, that they've been told off, that, oh, you shouldn't have used it. It's always fine to use it, even if they were perfectly healthy and you weren't sure. Then we'll say, oh, look, it turns out they've got tonsillitis. I've seen that before. But it doesn't matter because you were doing it to save their life and it's not going to harm.
So where do antihistamines come into it? They're kind of hay fever tablets. Can they be taken instead of, before adrenaline?
Not if you've got signs of anaphylaxis. So these are myths around antihistamines. So people will say antihistamines, if you take them early enough, they'll stop anaphylaxis occurring. They absolutely don't. That they treat anaphylaxis, they don't. Or that they'll mask anaphylaxis, they don't. They are blocking the histamine receptors. And histamine is the chemical that is released in an allergic reaction. So it will help you with hives, sneezing, itchy, runny eyes, abdominal pain, swelling. So it will make you feel better, and it is sensible to give it to try and help. And often that reduces everybody's anxiety. But actually, if you just left the hives, and I have seen some families, particularly when you've got young children and you don't yet know they've got allergies and you haven't got antihistamine, so they don't treat and it still resolves. But if anaphylaxis is going to occur, it will. And it's because not just histamine is released. There are other chemicals involved that antihistamines don't treat. Or there may be very high levels of histamine that are not going to be, you know, reversed or blocked with just one antihistamine. So if you've got signs of anaphylaxis, it's adrenaline, 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 adrenaline.
And that's the ABC.
Yeah, ABC.
And on the topic of Christmas, since we're so close to it now, we'll have people preparing Christmas dinners for their family and all gathering together. You often hear that cooking food eliminates allergens, which is something we need to be careful about, because if someone thinks that and they've someone with an allergy coming for dinner, that might not be the case. So when is it that cooking food eliminates allergens, and when doesn't it?
And I think it's because it's just all these parts of truth. I mean, that's where a myth comes from, isn't it? There's parts of truth in things, and that's why we just make our own assumptions. So for some foods, like particularly around milk and egg, when you cook them, you bake them, it unfolds the chain and they become less reactive for some. So you'd have to check. And actually, it can be the time where people with milk allergies particularly can fall up, because it depends on how you've baked it, how long you've baked it, as how reactive that allergen now is. So sometimes some of the deaths, and we've particularly seen it in America, have been around baked milk, because it's perhaps not as baked as people have necessarily thought. So if you're cooking for someone, I would steer clear, just don't use it. But if you're the parent or the person with the allergy, you will know, am I able to tolerate baked milk or egg or not? But for other allergens like peanut or tree nuts or sesame, cooking them doesn't change how reactive they are. They'll still react. So that's definitely not true.
So again, staying on that Christmas theme, we've got lots of articles and support information on the website. We've recently written something about how kitchens need to be prepared, and cleaning, and even cleaning the house when a guest is coming around that might have an allergy, and the fears that some people have of inviting somebody around because they don't want obviously anything to happen. But we've got tons of stuff on the website that are also worth looking at.
I always, you know, people who have allergies or their parents, they really want to be included. Ask them, what would I need to do to make you feel safe in my environment? And follow that. You know, if it's, could you just put the nuts away or the milk away? Would you mind if we bought oat milk with it? You know, that we will, as allergy parents, I've been there. I don't expect everyone to alter everything. I it's always amazing if people did go above and beyond and cook when they used to cook for my son. But otherwise, I'd bring the stuff with me. But I don't want these oh, a little bit won't hurt him, or I don't want those myths thrown at me. I just want to come and have a normal day, but just respect my rules around how I'm going to keep myself or my child safe, and just be collaborative in working towards that.
I think it's easy to be embarrassed, isn't it? It's yeah. Even if, you know, if you're the one without the allergy and you're inviting somebody with an allergy to your home, it's a bit embarrassing to say, well, you know, let's kind of delve into something that is quite personal.
It can be personal, and it is hard, isn't it? Because it is a health, you know, there aren't many medical conditions where you have to declare it at a restaurant, but you're doing it to keep safe. And if you don't, the processes won't go on to make sure it's definitely allergen free for you. They're just, you're making assumptions that might not be right because you can't see what's going on in the kitchen. So unfortunately, we do have to declare it to keep you safe. Don't be embarrassed about it. It is just another health condition. Just like I've had cancer, I'm not embarrassed. It's like it's not my fault. It just is what it is. But, you know, sometimes you have to involve other people to keep you safe. That's okay.
Yeah. I thought about that the other day because obviously now it's a lot more common to get restaurants where you can have vegetarian food, vegan food, pescatarian food. And I thought, a lot of the time, including myself, we don't have a problem going into a restaurant and telling them that we are vegan or vegetarian, but that's a choice. It's not a health condition. Yeah. So people with allergies should absolutely just go in and tell them, as people who make that choice do. It's actually something you can't avoid. So it's, you know, it's very important that they feel they can go and do that.
And it's a routine question now. So it's important.
Yeah.
Share, or the processes won't go on, and you won't necessarily be as safe as you think you are. You might think you've ordered a salad and it's safe, and you don't know what's gone on in the kitchen. So, yeah.
But equally, for somebody listening that hasn't got the allergy, that is inviting somebody around to a meal or going out for a meal, is to ask, you know, how can I make this more welcoming for you? How can I make this more pleasant for you?
Yeah. Just like I actually had a friend years ago, and I cooked lasagna for her. She was my boss at the time. She came round and she had the dinner, so I thought. And later on, I found out she was vegetarian. And I said, I cooked lasagna. She said, yeah, I only ate the topping. I was like, why did you tell me? You know, and it would be the same. I can't keep you safe in my setting if you don't tell me. And most people are good human beings and want to help and understand. And if they don't, you don't want to be there anyway. So choose your friends wisely. You can't choose your family, but you can you can control and say, I'm really sorry, come to me, you know.
Great. I know you've got to get away, Helen, because you've got an appointment. Yeah. So thank you so much for joining us. This has been great to bust some of those myths. And yeah, thanks for your time. And we'll have you on soon again, I hope.
Yeah. Anytime. And if, you know, if people are struggling, we have got a free Facebook group, along with obviously all the wonderful Anaphylaxis UK support. So it's Allergy Support Group with Dr. Helen Allergy. I do a live once a month to try and help combat some of these. They're often myths that come up, and give some support.
As always, Alan, thank you very much indeed. And of course, a very Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Happy Christmas, everyone.
We hope you enjoyed tuning in to today's podcast on this very important topic. To make sure you don't miss any episodes, you can subscribe to our podcast on your favourite podcast app, including Spotify and Apple Music. Finally, be sure to follow us on social media at Anaphylaxis UK to join in the conversation. And let us know if there are any questions you would like us to answer next time.